The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 20, from the Record of Going Easy, Dizang's Intimacy. Dizang asked Fa Yan, "Where are you bound?" Yan said, "Meandering monk travel." Zhang said, "What is the point of a monk's travels?" Yan said, "Don't know." Zhang said, "Not knowing is most intimate." Yan opened wide, great realization. And Hungjer's poem that accompanies this koan. Now, participating to the full appears at this time. Completely drop the finest separation. Arrive at not knowing. Let the short be short. Let the long be long. Stop cutting and stitching. Accord with high, accord with low, leveling the self. A family's extravagance or frugality is a temporary function, roaming across a fine field, sauntering about. The matter of going forth on a 30-year pilgrimage, clearly ungrateful for one pair of eyebrows. So we've heard beautiful commentaries on this koan so far, and maybe we've been commenting in our own minds. Our beautiful talk from David Roshi yesterday, the Dharma dialogue that followed, full of each person's wisdom and confusion and understanding, as if those two things were different. We heard Alan's lovely talk last night, bringing it home to the history of the self, because all of us have a history of ourself that we can tell. And lots of research has gone into the weird ways that memory works for people. We're never telling what actually happened because too many things happened. So we have to selectively cherry pick little items and string them together like beads on a necklace. And then that's the story of ourself. Everyone here listening to this talk, whether in this moment or sometime in the future on a recording, you all, we all have done this. We've all created a self-narrative that we really believe in, even though if we look at it clearly, we see that it's changed over the years of our lives. Some things that seemed important in the past are no longer important. Some things that were trivial in the past are now important. All Buddhas through space and time, that wonderful line in our chant book, space and time contain myriad Buddhas all arising right here. Space and time are not some narrative flow of past to present to future. Dogen famously said that the timeline of realization, the timeline of a realized person, is from the present to the past and the present to the future. Everything is here. Everything arising is arising now. And this amazing koan, we were saying, the teachers were saying to each other before Sesshin, that we could have based a whole month's worth of teaching on it. And you think, well, not really. It's so straightforward. Where are you going? I don't know. Not knowing is most intimate. That's pretty straightforward, I guess. We don't know what's happening. We don't know where we're going. And when we really come to that not knowing, honestly, not through a knowing that people are supposed to not know, not through trying to be good Zen students, oh, I'm not supposed to know things. But then that gets confusing because there is stuff you're supposed to know. How can not knowing and knowing exist together? And this is what we talked about a little bit yesterday in the Dharma dialogue. So I love Hongzhi's line here in the verse. Completely drop the finest separation. Arrive at not knowing. In other words, don't try to figure this out. Figuring out our lives is so tiring. We are addicted to it. We can't help ourselves. It's the way we were raised to think and feel. It's the way we were raised in this culture, even though we're from various cultures, still the culture of coming together now here is something we all share. And then we come together here to see through our enculturation, to see through this tendency of the mind to make things up. I notice that most of the things that I make up, which seem so real to me in the moment that I'm making them up, if I sit in their presence, they dissolve. If I try to get rid of them, they just get stronger, almost more stubborn. This spacious awareness that we're cultivating here, letting things come and go, not letting things go, getting rid of things, but knowing that the natural tendency of everything is to come and go. And that includes these really dearly held and beloved self narratives. I am a person who, and everybody listening to this talk right now has a capacity for filling in the blank at the end of that question. I'm a person who found the great way. How lucky I am. I'm a person who is a Zen practitioner. I'm a person at Sesshin. I made this effort to come to a very difficult, challenging experience. Look at me, look at me, look at me. Or maybe we look at me in the other way, which I think is more common. I'm just a screw up. There's no question. This is not a story. I have evidence. I have my case file right here. And I can show you from the moment that I began being conscious as a child, all the ways I've gone wrong, all the ways that I have messed up, said things, done things that caused harm to myself and others. Both of these self narratives, the positive ones and the negative ones, are simply constructions, because we're all in the construction business, as we say. This is how brains have developed to make sense of the world. And it's a good thing. We don't want to get rid of it. We want to really know that if there's something in front of us on the floor, like this big microphone, we shouldn't get up and walk through it because it's just a narrative of the mind. It's real. It's sitting here. It would be foolish to not see that, to take care of our bodies, to go to the bathroom, to feed ourselves, to sleep, to hydrate. These things have to be done. It's not just a theory. But it can seem that way. We can put ourselves last in this enterprise that we think we're supposed to be doing of learning not to know. So it's more complex than that. Not such a simple koan. Not such a simple life that we're leading. And Hongzhi's verse continues beautifully, but I won't read it all. But I just want to focus on a little bit of the ending. Running across a fine field, sauntering about. This is the second use in this poem of the word fine. Completely drop the finest separation, Hongzhi says earlier. And then he says, roaming across a fine field, sauntering about. What is he pointing to here? What is it that we already know about this fineness? The word fine in English has so many meanings. If you're somebody who doesn't like to talk about yourself and somebody asks you how you are, your response is fine. Even if you woke up with a terrible headache and your life is falling apart, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. David and I love to watch British mysteries on our streaming services, and we've gotten to predict when somebody whose loved one's just been murdered or they've just been attacked or, you know, how are you? I'm fine, I'm fine. No worries. So this is one way of using the word fine. Just stay away from me. I don't want to tell you how I am. And then fine also means something that is very close. This is another translation sometimes of the kind of intimacy we're talking about in Zen. So close. No gap, we say. And this is what I believe Hongzhi is pointing to here. Completely drop the finest separation, the smallest, the most delicate, the closeness even. Just be the thing that you are experiencing. If you're angry, then an angry moment has arisen in the world, in the field of awareness. Anger fills our being for that moment. And if the mind comes in and tries to figure out, now, why did I get angry? Or, oh, I shouldn't be angry. I'm a terrible student of Zen. That's awful. Or whatever arises in the construction business. That's really not separating. And then what happens to me anyway, when I do that, is that because I'm not fighting reality anymore. And I had a wonderful counselor who used to tell me, if you fight reality, reality always wins. Of course, if you fight anger, it just gets hotter and stronger. You don't want it to be here. So it's almost like anger has a mind of its own. And it says, you don't want me to be here? Well, let me show you how I can push back. Sadness, exactly the same. Irritation, fear. All of these things that we try to understand through thinking about them. I think it was Michael who said yesterday to beware of the word why. Now, it's a good thing, I think, in some places to wonder why. It's good that scientists have wondered about why viruses behave the way they do, so that they could use science to keep us healthier. But ultimately, the why of the self ends in a place of no satisfaction. There is just this, and stopping fighting is so important. I also wanted to read you one of the reasons we thought we could go on and on and on about this koan is that Wansong, the great teacher who collected these 100 verses of what we call the Book of Serenity and what Dosho Port Roshi calls the Book of Going Easy, or the Record of Going Easy. Serenity, ease. When we stop fighting reality, there is an ease that arises, a spaciousness. Don't assume that I'm talking about the truth here, but test it. Find out for yourself. What would happen if we stopped fighting reality? Clarity could arise and show us the way forward. To show us the way forward means that things become clear about how we can be effective in the world. We ourselves, the person sitting here listening, everyone is unique in the gifts we bring to the world. in the gifts we bring to our Zen practice. We really see this at Sesshin. Those of you who are here in person know that this is like a great choreographed improvisational dance. And I say both choreographed and improvisational because we have this officer's manual that tells you everything you're supposed to do. And it's really complicated and confusing. But it's like the background for what we actually end up doing, taking a step, raising a glass, ringing a bell. Moment after moment, everyone here is contributing in this great participatory dance of the Dharma. And everyone on Zoom is doing the same thing. Just by sitting down and turning on your computer, you contribute to the great dance of learning and insight. Nobody is apart from this. My first teacher used to say, you may think you're special, but you're not, but you are unique. He made a big difference between those two words. Unique is that there's never been anybody with your particular blend of cells and bones and muscles and DNA and brain waves. Nobody is the same. Even identical twins aren't the same. Even clones aren't the same, because experience comes in and molds whatever we came into the world with. So we're not special because we understand that all human beings suffer. This was the great understanding of the Buddha. But we all suffer in different ways, and all human beings have gifts, but we have different gifts. So when we stop fighting reality, when we settle into our seat and lift up our spine and be the noble one that we are, that is our birthright, then discoveries arise that are really surprising. If we're trying to get enlightened, for example, what blocks us is our narratives and stories about enlightenment. If we're trying to not know, because we've just been told that not knowing is most intimate, then we try to do that. We try to figure it out. We're so good at figuring things out. But the thing is, at least my experience is, that when I stop all that fighting and also the running away, which is a partner to the fighting, when I just sit in the presence of these things without the finest separation, then things rise up to hold me, to comfort me. My body breathes itself. My blood flows through, it beats my heart. All of the organs of my body work not quite as beautifully as they did 40 years ago, but they work pretty well and they keep me alive. And if I were in charge of any of those things, I would be dead in a moment. This is not our job to be in charge. We only have a little bit of efficacy, and that efficacy is where we put our attention, how we hold ourselves, and then from that moment, what choice we make to go forward. And we do divide ourselves from ourselves. This isn't just dividing ourselves from other things or from thoughts or emotions or physical sensations. We divide the sense of ourselves from other senses of ourselves. There's the good Melissa and the bad Melissa, the good Fred and the bad Fred. There's a constant pushing away of parts of the self that are so important. So one song adds many stories, koan stories, to the koan itself to illuminate it, and also to Hangzhi's verse. And I wanted to just comment a little bit, read it to you, and comment a little bit on the last story that explicates the verse. Because when I first read it, I laughed out loud. I thought, what is going on here? Who are these people talking to us from 1,000 years ago? Could they really be serious? So here's the story. Mouth asked
knows. Eating and drinking are possible because of me. Speaking is possible because of me. What service do you offer that gives you the right to be above me? And I've looked at a lot of translations of this story. There are no names here. It's the name is Mouth and Nose. So Ms. Mouth and Mr. Nose, I don't know. But Nose replies, in the midst of the sacred five peaks, the central peak is the most honored position. And apparently, what Wan Song is doing here is comparing the face to the landscape of China, where the mountain at the center is the most important mountain. So this little mountain in the middle of our face. And then Nose turns and asks, eyes, why are you above me? Eyes says, we are the same as the sun and moon, truly shining like mirrors. Now that's service. Dare we ask you, eyebrows, what service do you perform that you are above us? Eyebrows said, we're really of no service and no merit. It is so embarrassing to sit in the seat of honor. If you allow us to be under you, then with eyes above, we'll really look. What face holes you will be then. So what an interesting story about the separation of the different parts of the self, or even the separation we make of the different parts of our community. This is better than that. I'm better than you. If we got stuck in the kind of dialogue that these parts of the face are having, I don't think we'd ever get anything done. But we do. We really do. We think this is good, this is bad. The eyes, the mouth, and the nose forgets that the air moves in and out through the nose, but he's just more preoccupied with being right at the center of everything. How wonderful, how important. But eyebrows really has the final word, and there's some commentary on this, and I have a little to say about it too. And I was inspired by one of you yesterday picking up that line from the verse, what's going on with the eyebrows? And in Zen practice and in Zen tradition, eyebrows are very significant. Apparently, if you are a Dharma teacher and you do not speak the truth, you will lose your eyebrows. Now, I actually know a few Dharma teachers who don't have eyebrows, or they're losing their eyebrows, and they still are pretty wise and wonderful and compassionate. But that's the tradition. And sometimes there's a koan where somebody says, I want to ask you all, have I lost my eyebrows? Like, am I really making sense to you? Is this okay? It's like asking, is this okay? Always a trap if somebody says, how am I doing? But there was one teacher long ago. He was an Indian teacher, Pindala. And he was one of the Buddha's followers way back 2,600 years ago. And he was famous for having really long eyebrows, which, you know, was a sign of wisdom. But I can't imagine that they were easy to maintain. And there are stories of him speaking and then putting his hands up to his eyebrows and moving them away from his eyes. So here the eyebrows have something important to say. We're really of no service and no merit. I remember reading years and years ago a text by Thomas Merton, the wonderful Catholic monk who studied Zen and Taoism and wrote some books about them. Wonderful Zen stories and Taoist stories. And he has a lovely passage about the uselessness of a certain kind of tree that can't be used to build anything because it's not strong enough, that bears no fruit. And he compares being a monk to being like that kind of tree, useless. Not the person you turn to for wisdom, not the one you turn to for help even, but the one who moves through the world, who moves through the vast fields, the finest fields, who's dedicated not to being somebody important, but to seeing through being. And this is, of course, what the koan rests upon too. It's not that Fayan has a realization because suddenly his teacher says something to him. Wang San also comments about that the teaching in this koan is subtle. And I think that Hongzhi's line about coming to not knowing is the crux of that. This is a development. This is like cooking a soup, a delicious, delicious soup. We know what that's like, those of us who are here at the temple, because we get to have soup every night made by our gifted Tenzo. She's useful. But if she were to ground herself in being useful, I don't think we'd ever get that yummy soup. The distraction would be too much. Try to be a good cook and you get tangled up. Try to be a good bell ringer and you just keep missing. You try to be a good teacher and you get lost. Over and over again, this trying, as anyone knows who's a Star Wars fan, is not the way to go. And if you don't understand that reference, it's a wise little person saying, don't try, only do. Moving forward, breath after breath, this is how we interact with the world in the finest, most intimate way. We have to have an intention to make the soup. But if we think, I am a really good soup maker, the soup will not have a yummy taste. This happens over and over again. I won't give you more examples, but I think you know what I'm talking about. So to be useless, the eyebrows are useless. There's no merit to it. And then I love that he says, the eyebrows say, it's so embarrassing to sit in the seat of honor. Let me change my position. Let me go below the eyes. That would be interesting. It is completely unnecessary to change your position. It is completely unnecessary to change who you actually are in the most deep fundamental level. Who you are the only person who can have your realization. It doesn't look like anybody else's. It doesn't feel like anybody else's. Your wisdom, your compassion. There's no other way than your way forward. Even though the self is a construction, it's a useful construction. We can rely on it. We can let ourselves sink into our own honest experience of each moment without trying to be like the person we read about in the book or the person we heard about in a Dharma talk. Who is this person sitting here now listening to the talk? Who is listening? Who is hearing? Who is tasting, smelling, talking? Who is seeing, smelling, and who is here now? Who are you? If you try to answer that question, the addiction of the mind to creating self-stories will just get in your way. But if you keep that question with you as a way of wondering, a way of truly not knowing, Bodhidharma said, there is no knowing. He didn't say, I don't know, literally in Chinese. He said, no knowing. And in this translation also, Bayan says, no knowing. Nothing in the way. So Zen Master Bao Ming has a comment on this story of Wansong's, which must have come from some other source, who knows where. He goes up to the main hall and he says, an ancient one said, in the eye, it's called seeing, in the ear, it's called hearing. Yet Say, in the eyebrow, what's it called? Here we are again, right? And then he paused for a long time. And then he said this. In sorrow, we grieve together. In laughter, we find the same joy. This is where all the parts come together, all the human being self stories come together, all the internal self stories, the good one and the bad one, the stupid one and the wise one, the warm and kind one and the mean one, all the different parts of themselves come together as one whole person. Only human beings appear to divide up the self in this way. Only human beings appear to divide between each other and create wars and violence and injustice. None of the dogs or cats that I've known in my life sit around and talk about these things. They just slurp up their food if they're a dog, or delicately pick at their food if they're a cat, and go on their way. But really, we're all one body. The whole universe is one body. Sometimes we say it is the Tathagata's body, the one who thus comes and thus goes, which is what the Buddha called himself. One body functioning in a way that we can't even see because we're just one little part. We're the nose, we're the mouth, we're the eyes, we're the eyebrows. We don't know what our function is. And Bao Ming says, everyone knows about useful functions, but don't know about the useless, great function. Yet when Arhat Pindala, that's the guy with his eyebrows, brushed his eyebrows with both hands, what was his intent? Won't comment on that line. That's another koan in itself. What was he doing? What do we do? Well, I will comment on it. What are we doing? What are we doing? We scratch our head, or we take a step forward, or we go to the snack table, or we plump up our pillow. What are we doing? Who's doing it? Who is the one who is beyond being functional? What happens when we're not functional, when we let ourselves not be functional? And really, Zazen is a way of practicing not being functional, because when we sit upright and unmoving, maybe we're doing breath practice, but we can't be with the breath for that long. So our mind drifts, and then we catch ourselves and we come back. As David said yesterday, this is the practice. It's not doing something. It's being in the flow of the way the mind and body work. Constant change, constant movement, useless. So we get to practice being useless. And if your practice is Shikantaza, that's even more direct, because Shikantaza is so indirect. Simply being present and watching, being with, that's not even the right word, being with, watching, simply thoughts, emotions, sensations, thoughts, emotions, sensations, nowhere to go, nowhere to be, just this. And then so the teacher who wrote this, Wan Song, in his commentary on what Bao Ming said, brushed his eyebrows and said, meow. It turns out that the word for meow in Chinese is the same as the word for cat. So perhaps in his little shocking way, meow, that's not an ordinary way of responding to a koan or a problem, but it is the ordinary way for those who do not try to make up things about the world, who don't try to be useful. Just before I started to give this talk, I was wondering what I was going to say. I had about a 4-hour talk planned, but it wasn't planned. I just wanted to get to that point and this point and this point and this point. And then suddenly I saw the Buddha on the altar. And in the Zen tradition, teachers don't give talks to the Sangha. They give talks to the Buddha. In some Zendos, a Buddha figure is in the middle of the room and the teacher's seat is right in front of it. Not where we've placed the teacher's seats, but still we're facing the Buddha. But everything else falls away in that moment. And there's only the great gratitude that I have for functioning in a way that all my random thoughts and feelings can come through my mouth. Not through my nose or my eyes, but through my mouth, not through my eyebrows, and deliver something, something about this great way, this great way that fills the universe. And if only we could stop being so busy making things up, harming ourselves, harming others, we could see it too. And I know that all of you have seen it at least in a glimpse, if not more than a glimpse. Cultivating that glimpse is our practice. Being here, just like this. So I'll read the poem one more time. Now, participating to the full appears at this time. Completely drop the finest separation, arrive at not knowing. Let the short be short. Let the long be long. Stop cutting and stitching. Accord with high, accord with low, leveling the self. A family's extravagance or frugality is a temporary function. Roaming across a fine field, sauntering about. The matter of going forth on a 30-year pilgrimage, clearly ungrateful for one pair of eyebrows. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. Let's make our little oval U-shape in the Zendo. All right, comfortable now? So raise your hand if you're in the Zoom, in the physical Zendo. Raise your Zoom hand if you're in the Zoom Zendo, and we'll have a little discussion about that. And we'll start with Sabrina. So Michael's going to do it. Ooh, look at that Zoom cam following. Very cool.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa. I had a question that came up for me. You mentioned you had narratives about yourself that come up and you sit with them and you see them, you come and go. And I was going to ask you, when is effort needed? Sometimes when I sit with my own narratives, I tend to ruminate. And I don't notice sometimes, and that's okay. So I was going to ask, like, is there, when is effort required and when is it not required? But yes. I think you answered it towards the end of your talk, and
yeah,
we don't know. Right.
Right. But you know, I'm just looking to see if my, friends here want to say something, and they're looking down very solemnly, so I'm thinking no. I think that's a really, really important question, because it's not one thing or the other. You know, in the Zen person rule book. There's no chapter on that one. And I'm joking, there's no Zen person rule book. But it seems like if we go, this is what we were talking about yesterday, if we just go in the direction of just do this, like only don't know, then we miss the importance of knowing, right? If we go with these narratives are false, but I'm ruminating about them, should I stop? Then that's yet the creation of another layer of narrative, isn't it? Yeah. So to allow the rumination to be present too in Zazen, but then sometimes to decide, you know what, I've had enough. I'm going to stop the rumination. Once you see it, you can turn your attention somewhere else, like to your breath. That's the little choice we have, right? The little bitty choice of changing our attention. So that's my understanding, that of course you can put effort into it. There is effort. You know, it takes effort for me to stand up. I have to put it in, or I just sit here all the time. So there's always effort, but it has to be this coming and going kind of effort. If we're always making effort, we'll get tired. If we're always giving up, we'll lose the tension. You know, and the Buddha has stories about the lute. And if the string is too loose, you don't get any music out of it. And if it's too tight, it snaps. So it's always finding this balance between one extreme and another. Yeah. Does that sit with how you're? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love your question. I also ask you to consider, what was your narrative when you were 15 years old? What was your narrative when you were 20 and 25, right? Did you have any control, or did you decide, well, now I'm 26, my narrative is going to be different? So just, you know, looking into that.
Thank you. Corwin.
Thank you, Melissa, for that lovely talk. You're kind of like Sabrina. I was caught up in, you know, trying versus not trying, when to do this, when to do that. But I was also struck by the eyebrows. You know, they said, well, I don't do anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at certain times, they're very helpful because they can be very expressive. And if you don't have facial expressions, it can be a problem. But I was thinking about your guidance at the beginning of this session, where we're not supposed to make nonverbal communication. So that's not a useful function during session. And yet their eyebrows also have a very passive function that may be not so useful anymore, but, you know, they shield the eyes from the sun, and they say that that might've been the original use of them. And so sometimes we can be wonderful without even knowing we're doing anything. And it kind of reminds me of David's talk from a week ago, where, you know, you can't see your own light. And that was floating through my head during the talk. So thank you.
You might say you can't see your own eyebrows.
Thank you. Who else would like to? Yeah, wow, lots of people. So Sabrina, why don't you pick somebody who just raised their hand?
I saw Laura's hand.
Great.
Yeah.
I have been learning Orioki like a lot of you, and the other night I felt like I had really got it, and I have the teachers right here that I've been studying, and they maybe can feel my eyes just peering over, and I was at the point where I had stacked my bowls, and I was going to do the kind of fancy tie that I saw them doing, and I heard Melissa say to me, "Great." And I was thinking, right? Yes, it's so great, I'm doing so well. And then she followed up by saying, "Don't tie it yet." And I realized that she had said, "Wait." And I was laughing so loud inside myself. And it was just such like one of those moments of cutting through my story. So I thought I'd share it.
Wait, that's great. but wait, you know, that I love what you're saying, because that's a perfect example of how we get blinded. We were so sure we want things to be a certain way. Yeah, it's just so relatable too, and funny. I was talking to one of you recently about this addiction of the mind to distractions. You know, it's like, if you don't have that, you may not understand what I'm about to say. But most people I know, right, we want something interesting and exciting. Breath practice is kind of dull, so we'll do all kinds of stuff. And the mind almost creates the addiction to distract us so that things keep going the same way. It's a little bit like what Sabrina was saying about rumination. It's almost like we have to practice those narratives and then get used to living inside of them and not being able to break through them. And when the only way that I've ever known to break through them is more in line with what I think that Hungjae was saying, you begin to see these things and they are delivered to you. And sometimes they're so clear that, you know, you just go, what? I heard weight is great. I just did something that a person like me shouldn't be able to do. That's where it goes. Mm-hmm. So we keep getting surprised. The breakthrough of the narrative is so important. But again, if we try to break through the narrative, then we become a person who's breaking through the narrative. So these are like little gifts that are given to us. That was a gift. And then you turned around, gave the gift to everybody just by telling the story, which is why we tell all these koan stories. Everybody in the koans that end with, and they came to a realization, or they've given us a gift. This is what happened for me. Yeah, surprise. Not what you thought. Thank you. Nobody on screen. So anybody in the Zendo? I knew there were other hands. Yeah, Modu.
Thank you for your talk. So what struck me was the uselessness of the eyebrows. So this machine, I also felt pretty useless. Because then yesterday I was so dizzy, I had to walk out. And then there was another time when I left the, mop there. So a lot of, really feeling useless in so many different ways. But at the same time, it's like the eyebrows, there is a sweetness to this feeling of uselessness that only the eyebrows understand. So, so it feels kind of okay and sweet at the same time, even though the eyebrows is useless, it's still okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, Madhu, you're pointing, as we do again and again, to our experience. So we have opinion, useful is good and useless is bad. And we might avoid one and try to cultivate the other, but finding our way into some new place. And I think we are all so tied to, what do I have to give? Am I good enough? What do people think about me? And there is some wonderful freedom in this uselessness, not to be shackled by our competence, right? But, perfectly useless. How wonderful, how sweet. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Nobody on screen, so back. Yep, go ahead, Deb.
Thank you for that beautiful talk. So what I noticed is, when you said our gifted Tenzo, of course my identities went, oh, look at me. And it's funny, because when I'm actually cutting things or stirring the pot, it's just the pot. It's not who's doing it. And then making the rice, I know I always talk about the rice, but it's just this thing about the rice cooker. It sings when you turn it on. And it was like, oh, I love this rice. Love towards the rice, burn towards the rice. But it was just, I just wanted to share that about how, you know, you hear something back and you want to take it on, I guess, and, you know, my new identity.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, beautiful. Beautifully said, too, because the ego wants to be special. It really does. You know, connecting that to what Modu just said, right? The sweetness of not being special. And just to catch that, it's so normal. You didn't, you know, and I took the risk of talking about you specifically, because I thought you would know how to rebound. Right from that, but I didn't know you could have then gone around with a very inflated head and all the food would taste terrible from now on.
I think you're pointing to something beautiful in that we're so apt to look at our function in the world as being useful or useless, you know, dividing us, and you're expressing something that's both. I mean, the usefulness of rice, but you're not worried about that. You're just kind of experiencing it. And that's really how this is. I mean, to worry about being useful is taking yourself out of the picture, essentially. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Madhu. The beauty of just, you know, being Madhu here in the temple, That's it. There's the usefulness.
Please excuse the interruption. The handheld mics are no longer working.
Maybe that one's not.
How about now?
Now it is.
Oh, yeah. The one
out in the room isn't working either. We couldn't really hear Modu or Deb.
Oh, it might be off.
Can you hear it now?
Yes.
So the on-off switch.
Up.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I turn it off when I give it to Michael. And then... That's okay.
Because they're in a little uselessness competition.
The thing I wanted to say in response is that we can go the other way. Well, how do we deal when people comment? Mm. And we can fend it off. Well, you know, no, I'm doo-doo. Right. Or we can take it to heart, and neither one is correct. When you have done a good job and someone says, oh, servers are so beautiful, you get to receive that and say thank you and then pass it on. It's if you get stuck there, and you can get stuck. Oh, server, I noticed that one foot was in the wrong place and I can't believe, don't you care about the Dharma, right? And we can get all upset about the corrections. So we get to receive good, bad, coming and going, and we can smile and forget about it and love the rice, right? The rice will save us. The serving, the kneeling will save us. Yeah.
You know, I think what David's saying is so important. I just want to underline it a little bit. I don't know if this is true for any of the rest of you, but some of you are in leadership positions. People will come to me and begin sentences with you. And I just know that's almost like a beginning of, oh, what is this person going to reveal about themselves? Because they say, I mean, if I really believed all the things people say about me, I would be really not here right now. I'd be in a padded room. It doesn't cohere because we're so complex as human beings. And if you've ever had that experience, you know that then the turn is not to go, oh, you idiot, you don't know me at all. It's to go, wow, really? Is that how you think? Is that how you feel? It's like loving the rice pot again, right? There's this is based in human relationships are complex and the ego is complex. And when they interact with each other, all kinds of weirdness can happen. And so I really feel like Zen practice is really good for being a person out in the world, you know, who has stuff to do and important things to take care of too, to be useful. It's good for useful people too. And any of us who feel useless also have that useful side, which I think both David and Michael were talking about. Yeah. So thanks. Pierce.
Melissa, thanks for talking about the little parable of the face, the features, the discussion of the feature, the conference of the features.
Yes, and
I'm amused by it, and I'm also touched by it. I mean, on the one hand, it's ridiculous, but that's the point. And it says something about, you know, it says something about the way in which we are divided and at odds with ourselves. And I mean, internally, each individual. And then also, as you pointed out, giving it a wider context, it says something about the way we interact with each other, the world over. And I just found your evocation of the one seamless body to be very touching, because you really evoked the fact that, as Hongzhi says somewhere, the whole thing is functioning effortlessly, but we don't know that. And so we are complicating matters. But yet, in listening to you, you know, I get a whiff. I have a suspicion that this is the case. And really, you know, that's why I'm here. That's why we're all here. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks. I'll make this quick. I just wanted to share something that came, a memory that came when you were talking also about the nose and the eyebrows and why one's above the other. And so it made me think of how when we look at faces, when I look at faces, I make all these quick classifications and judgment, like how old, how race, gender, et cetera, who is this person? I try to make sense of it. And the memory that came back was with my son and just flipping him upside down because he was so small and looking at his face. I don't know if anyone's ever done this, but looking at someone's face in the eyes when it's completely upside down, and it's absurd. It looks so stupid. It's crazy. Like, it looks like there's a mouth talking with teeth that are upside down and eyebrows are on the bottom. It looks like an alien. Like, it looks like, so you don't classify, you don't, and everybody laughs. Like, we laugh together because it's funny. And it's the same face. It's just, if you flip it upside down, it looks, I don't have any ideas about it anymore. So stuff.
You know, that experiment is sometimes done in psychology. You flip photographs, and the tendency of the human mind to create narratives is so strong that really everyone should do this. How many people have seen upside down pictures like this? Yeah. The nose your chin becomes your nose. Like the mind just sees the chin as the nose, because the nose is always above the mouth. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the face is sort of irrelevant. It's like hair. And so we just to watch that patterning that our minds pattern, they do, and to see through that is really difficult. So that's a wonderful, I recommend everyone should not turn Dave's son upside down. You're going to get a line outside your door. Can I do it? But just a photograph of yourself. It's really surprising. Esther.
So thank you for the sweetness of the talk. It sweeped through all the way into my living room here. And there's something about the word useless that is resonating deeply. And I was just thinking, you know, the different parts of the face, the different parts of, say, my workplace right now, where there's a situation we're trying to step in together and support each other in. The useless aspect or the quality that comes from it. I'm even wanting to let go of the word a little bit. How there is, it's pointing to the tapestry that we're part of in every moment in some way. And the, I think someone said something about the relief of, or the freedom that may come from recognizing not a particular use that we have to manifest in that moment, but listening in and functioning in the moment together. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear.
Yeah, no, I appreciate what you're saying, Esther, and what it brings up for me is that usefulness implies some other time. Mm-hmm. I do this now so that something else will happen. And that is indeed true. There are consequences to our actions. But I think in our Zen practice, we are focusing on the fullness and completeness of each moment, mm-hmm. right? Each moment in time. And we fulfill our bodhisattva vows not so something else will happen, but in the activity of bowing, in the activity of stepping in or stepping back, everything is accomplished already. And then we enter the next moment. And so this uselessness, or this not focusing, not thinking about the end, well, I'm going to get there. No, I'm here and here. And then we follow. And then this moment unfolds and blossoms into this moment. And this moment, and this moment. Yeah. And we take care of the future by taking care of here.
Right. And it's not abandoning the ego or the self. It's not abandoning community. It's kind of both. Mm-hmm. And it's the activity that we're dancing and moving around. So it's not oneness losing, you know, a sense of apart. But
yes, I'm still hoping that we can eat the rice for lunch today. Even though Deb has loved it thoroughly already, hoping that it will be cooked at some point.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. What started coming up for me and what I wanted to share was some of the ways that I would let my narratives about myself really dominate me for a really long time. And it totally destroyed me for a while. Like just letting, taking really personally every single praise and every single criticism that I received in such a way that I would let the praises really, really build me up until I had this really, really inflated view of myself. And then something would happen, like someone wouldn't like me, God forbid such a thing would happen, and it would all come crumbling down, and it was just like total mental breakdown, like horrible, really difficult. And then I would hold other people to that standard that I would hold myself, and it would lead me into a world of trouble. And thankfully somehow I've been able to get to know that better, and it's not as difficult anymore. But I just wanted to share that.
Oh, thank you so much. I saw a bunch of nods around the room, right? This is such an important thing to see, the inflation and deflation. I think we've been pointing to it. We call it praise and blame in Zen, and it happens all the time. I don't know if it's possible to make it end. I mean, it still happens to me, but to catch it, you know, like Deb demonstrated with the great cook thing, just to see how we're fragile beings. We're easily wounded and easily pumped up. And just to see that it's the rising and falling, you know, like Hongzhi is talking about, be short when you're short or long when you're long, something like that. When you're inflated, really to feel the inflation, mm-hmm. and when you're deflated, really to feel the deflation. And I think those swings can start to modulate the more attention we bring to them. But that's an experiment that every one of us has to do for ourselves. I don't see anybody else on Zoom. Maybe, yes, we've got two people in the Zendo. So let's go with Seth first and then Chad, and then maybe we'll end.
Hi. Can you help me? What was the line the eyebrow said? Like, we're so embarrassed. For whatever reason, I was so inspired by the eyebrows. Okay. I can't remember the exact phrasing.
Seat of honor.
So embarrassing. I also like how they talk together. The two of them give a press announcement. this phrase, like, it is so embarrassing. I was just so inspired by that. They got asked a question like, hey, what gives you the right? And they're like, I don't know. And they're like, it's embarrassing. How many times do I get asked a question and I want to like explain, why did you do that? What if I could just go, it's so embarrassing. I don't know why. There's a way that our lives are really embarrassing. We do so many things. We don't know why. They just happen. Then like we become this person we didn't choose. There's no reasons for things. Sesshin's like that, right? It manufactures so many embarrassing moments. And I don't think about embarrassment that much for myself. We don't talk about that much in Zen, but I think it's actually such a big part of our practice. And I'm thinking for myself, like in Dokusan, what do I say, not say, because I'm worried I'll be embarrassed? So I feel courageous from the eyebrows. They just, I want to be like,
As if you remind me of a radio interview I heard with Oliver Sacks, and he was talking about his daily routine. And he said, I have very particular things. And on Tuesday, I always eat lentils, and I have half a cup of lentils at lunch, and I have this. And he was like really kind of obsessive. And the guy interviewing him, so you're this wonderful guy. You seem kind of obsessed about food. Aren't you embarrassed? He said, yes, I'm terribly embarrassed about it. And it was so inspiring. He did not try to hide anything. He said, yes, this is how it is for me and food. And I find it very embarrassing.
That's right. And you know, I love what you're saying too, Seth, because the Sesshin manufactures embarrassment. Is that what you said? I really think so. I think the whole koan system manufactures embarrassment. You have to show up as an idiot. You know, you have to take these chances and not know. And part of the work before being able to show up that way is seeing what's in the way of showing up that way. And I think, you know, all the opportunities for embarrassment at Sesshin and in Dokusan, you get over and over and over again. I mean, I get over and over and over again the patterns that I use to protect myself from embarrassment. But I'm like constantly, and shame is the other word that I like to use too. I'm just so ashamed. I can't believe I did that or said that or no, what must they be thinking? Oh God, giving a Dharma talk is really good for that. It's just incredibly wonderful. Exposed, the old teachers say. And that's a compliment.
Just, you know, at this point, what you're saying so beautifully points to this tendency I have, and I assume everyone shares this, is just to construct reality for others so that they can see it. This is who I am. See? And put it up there. And then when Sesshin breaks that, which it always does, it's like, they're really seeing me. No.
And
what came up for me was the you were talking about not fighting reality, and isn't that another pit to fall into?
Not fighting reality.
Yeah. Like if you're fighting reality is what's happening and you're trying not to fight reality, right. Isn't that fighting reality?
Totally. Yeah. Right. Because that's the subtlety. That's what I love about the line in the poem about, I keep forgetting it because it, you know, it's revelatory to me. So when I get something that's revelatory, then I can't remember it anymore. Arrive at not knowing is like taking it out of, you know, the effort that Sabrina was talking about, do this or do not do this, are opposite pairs. And there's a way of finding freedom, right? It's not fighting reality and it's not fighting reality. And as Nagarjuna would say, and it's also fighting reality and not fighting reality. And it's neither, like the what? It's all those things all mixed together. So there's no, that's why there is no Zen person rule book, because there's no way to know how to do this. But I think to let ourselves feel shame when it arises, feel embarrassment when it arises, and feel the truths of various moments that come up, clarity like you just had, bless you. That's it's just one step after the other, isn't it?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And thank everyone. Wow, so lucky, huh? Let's please restore the Zendo, come back to your sitting posture.